Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for my podcast, Great New American Essays. The series appears here on the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's spotlight is on the literary magazine, The Georgia Review. I'm joined by both the magazine's director and editor, that's Gerald Ma, and by the magazine's associate prose editor, Maggie Sue. Since Gerald took over his current role in 2019, the Georgia Review has won the National Magazine Award for Best Fiction, as well as awards like the Robert Dow Penn Prize, Best New Poets, and the O. Henry Prize. Before the Georgia Review, he was an editor-in-chief of the anti-profit, the Asian American Literary Review, which he founded with his colleague Lawrence Min Yu Davis in 2009. Maggie Sue is the author of the forthcoming novel, Blob, from Harper, 2025. She holds a PhD in fiction from the University of Cincinnati, and her short fiction has appeared or is forthcoming in the New England Review, Tri-Quarterly Review, and elsewhere. Thank you both for joining me here on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. So tell me a bit about the Georgia Review. Its heritage, what in your mind you think maybe distinguishes it from some other magazines out there? Anything you might want to say is a bit of a shout out for the magazine itself.
Yeah, I don't mind your shirt.
Yeah, I think you should.
I mean, you know, I think a magazine's a weird thing because it's, especially a literary journal, it's a weird thing because it's a periodical, and especially one that's kind of been around for such a long time. There's this essay by Marion Moore about editing The Dial, and she says, you know, when there are successive editors, it's not a smooth line. It's more like rings of a tree. It's because they're different, you know?
Sure. Makes sense.
Yeah. And, but it's also, you know, part of the rings of the tree is like, it's all one organism as well, you know? So when asked this question, it changes from day to day, but I think, in terms of like what I'm thinking right now, especially with your interview, one of the things I really find distinctive about the Georgia Review is that, as a literary journal, we are blessed to have a robust office. There's myself, there are two associate editors who have PhDs in creative writing, they're publishing. This is all that they do. It's their career. We have two full-time graduate students whom we pay, and that's like their whole thing. And so one thing I'll throw out there that I am very proud of is that the Georgia Review is a literary review in which every single unsolicited submission is read by a salaried professional. And I think that's something I'm really proud of. One of the things, qualities of the journal that we like is that we take the review part very seriously. It's read by everybody. Everybody who reads every submission is read by someone who's getting paid. But we have these kind of discussions about it within these kind of different offices. And it really is kind of a conversation in the office with the writers, with the readers. And 5 years into this job, I really see that kind of, you know, getting paid forward.
And that magazine has a great tradition behind it. So as a ring on the tree, so to speak, how do you see your ring as maybe different than the ones before me? What's changing the literary landscape? What's your unique voice or experiences you might bring to it? Anything on that light? And Maggie, feel free to join in.
Yeah, I feel like we're kind of, you know, we have this tradition of environmental writing at the Georgia Review. And I think you can see that continued on. Gerald has brought in this wonderful, we're working a lot with pieces in translation. I see the Georgia Review, what's beautiful about it is we do have this legacy. It is kind of a old school. We have full-time staff. Like, we don't rely on volunteer readers. And I think that I've worked at a lot of different literary journals. And what's really exciting about the Georgia Review is we're able to kind of have that back and forth. I think we're not expecting pieces to come in being perfect. We can do developmental edits. We can have Zoom conversation with authors. I've never had that yet. The other journals I've worked with. And so I think kind of having that foundation of the commitment to literature has been it's been amazing as we're kind of changing and growing and finding different voices and curating different, as you can see from the variety of essays that we publish, we're having a lot of different, we're getting new voices in to the conversation, and it's a really exciting time.
Okay, so I'm going to move on to some of those issues that you would kindly sent me. I'm going to start with an essay that really grabbed my attention, Campus Maximus. This is by Christopher Kemp. It's from the winter 2023. Probably one of the reasons autobiographically, he's talking about 1969 and a African-American student rebellion at Cornell University. Just so happens in 1969, I moved from St. Paul down to the college town of Northfield, Minnesota. And I remember the first thing I noticed was every single stop sign in town had been spray painted. So it now read, "War, Stop War." So I suddenly realized I was in a very different setting, but particularly at Carleton, the buildings were that kind of baronial estate that the writer is talking about. What struck you about the piece? I mean, I'm coming from an autobiographical angle, but there's a lot more about the piece than that, certainly. But I want you to jump in here as to how it distinguished itself in your eyes.
Well, when I first saw it, you know, I had known Christopher Kemp as a name and as a writer, as a poet, and also as an academic critic. You know, he has an academic monograph and he has books of poetry. And so first and foremost, I was like, oh, an essay, you know? That's great. And we love to be surprised and we love to talk about these surprises. What I found kind of the second order of it that I really enjoyed is, you know, it right now is a renaissance in what in academia people call public writing, you know, people who are academically trained who want to share their expertise in a venue that is not so kind of inward facing. And I see that very much with this piece, you know, like it really is a take on this rebellion by a student group at a certain time. It is definitely kind of right on in terms of the exigence of, you know, Black Lives Matter and all that stuff, but it is kind of putting it within larger historical context. But then, you know, why the Georgia Review? There are kind of very strategic and profound moments of memoir that come into it, you know?
Yeah.
And I just thought it worked really well for a journal that is trying to, you know, welcome public writing by, you know, academically trained people as well. And so it was a pleasure to kind of read that and work with him with that essay.
Sure. And Maggie, for your part, anything you wanted to add in?
Yeah, I just think, you know, we're also, you know, we're housed in the libraries at UGA. We're always thinking about the kind of divide between town and gown, the campus and politics, and like this interwoven historical example with the speaker's kind of personal experience in academia. It was just really compelling, and we thought it was a great fit for the journal.
Sure. I mean, one detail, for instance, speaking of the town versus gown, the fact that apparently in 1355, a riot at Oxford led to over 60 students and faculty members being killed. Because if I remember right, no one actually dies in the rebellion at Cornell. But 60 people is a lot of bodies, a lot of people. Really speaks to a strong conflict there. And in this case, it's, you know, I've been to the campus many times. You know, it's overlooking the town literally and figuratively. The fact that the mayor, who was a dropout of Cornell, was interested in storming the campus just speaks to the fact that there are some pretty strong caricatures or characters who get invoked here in the piece. Any last thoughts before we move on that particular essay?
Yeah, I think just as an example of something that Maggie Sue said, we have the immense privilege of having the bandwidth to have editorial engagement. And for those who end up writing, you know, academic papers on this essay and whatnot, a little archival stuff here, but, you know, the original submission came in, I forgot the exact title, but the title, like, basically tapped into the town and gown trope, you know? And one of the things that Chris and I talked about was, you know, that was the title and it motivated the writing, but in the kind of really kind of deliberate writing, and also, you know, open writing, when you read through that, it's really not a town and gown split. It's like the divide is within the gown, right? It's like, it's, you know, it's the Black students, you know, and the administration. And so the story that he kind of, by writing the story, kind of, you know, trying to get it right, it actually, in a way, for me, provided a stark example that town and gown divide is a little too ossified and a little too pat, you know? And so we talked a little bit about that, and he, you know, it's mostly there. He fudged a couple of, you know, he elaborated a little bit more, and I was like, these points might be, you know, might cause, you know, you might want to meditate a little bit more on this, that, and the other. But that's one of the things that kind of came through our, that little bit of a zhuzhing, you know, came through our exchange, and I think it's all the better. And so Campus Maximus is, if you think about it, in a way, it's a critique of town and gown, because it's the campus leveraging a perceived town and gown divide to suppress the thing within the town, you know, within the gown, you know. It's a profound essay in a lot of ways.
Yeah, no, I think it is a profound essay. The Maximus really prepared me for bigger stakes. And to your point, not only is there divides within the gown, there are divides within the town. People who work for it, some happily, maybe some not so much. Rural people in the nearby community who are still very much informed by its presence. Yeah, there's a lot of different elements going on. So let's move to a second essay. This one is by Mary Margaret Alvarado. It's called Chopping Up the Gun. It's from the fall 2023 issue. So it has a lot of statistics, and anyone can marshal statistics. So my question is, how did you get beyond the statistics, as numbing and as horrifying as they are, to say, this is a piece that, whether it's developmental editing once again, or it's ready to go as is, seized you?
Yeah, we did do some developmental edits on this one. You know, the reportage on gun violence and mass shootings, like just letting that sit, letting that speak to people, like mixed with these kind of really interesting images of the guns being chopped up, yes, turned into garden tools, toys, jewelry, sculptures by this Raw Tools, this company. And so what we kind of did was bring out, you know, the scene, bring out kind of her journey going to see and speak to these folks who are choosing to turn in guns, and their thoughts, feelings about that. So it was a more about kind of adding in little moments of insight, pulling back maybe on some of the statistics a little bit, and letting them not overwhelm, letting them sit with the reader kind of in conjunction with this scene that's going on in the essay.
Sure. And one of the things that I was looking for, and I found it, was, you know, a voice that spoke to me through and beyond the statistics. So at one point, and maybe almost the most important line for me, even though it might seem like it's a throwaway, but I don't think it was, is she said, the cars are waiting as though for French fries or absolution. And the juxtaposition there could be as trivial as pulling up to McDonald's and just a routine, I'm handing off the gun, to a profoundly moving thing that I am letting this go. I recognize its significance and the damage it does, and I'm looking for salvation through release of it. That little passing phrase, I thought really, you know, packed a lot into it, and I really welcomed it. Gerald, anything you wanted to say here?
Yeah, I agree. I think the literariness of it is just is the start of the key. You know, is the key. We did publish another essay of hers, kind of my first year here, and it is like an aesthetic construction. it is like a Mallarmean kind of, like, you know, world of a book. It has political implications, but it is, like, you know, aesthetic first and foremost. And so it was really interesting to see that kind of her do something different, you know. And the writer Alex Chi came and visited us at UGA maybe last month. And for those who don't know him, you should go out and read his stuff, because he's just absolutely amazing. But, you know, he writes fiction as much as nonfiction. And I don't have the air of genius that Alex You know, someone was asking him, you know, what's the difference between fiction and, you know, when you're writing fiction and nonfiction. And it sounds so basic, but it made me think of something, you know, it was very thought provoking to me. But he was just like, well, in fiction, I'm building out a world and with my thoughts, and with nonfiction, there is this world given to me and I need to get it right, you know, and that, you know, I need to be accurate was his word.
Sure. Although I always think of the Mark Twain line, the only problem with fiction is it has to make sense, because the real world so often does not. So it is given to you, but it's given to you warts and all. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, I think in conversation with that Twain thing, though, I think like a literary essay, though, what's interesting about being accurate with an essay, but also doing the literary thing, is that literariness is something that invites multiple meanings, you know, whether it's a metaphor, difficult syntax, you know, connotation, denotation. It's all about myriad meanings within, you know, given language. And so to get something right, but also equally be beholden to myriad meanings, I think is really the power of like literary essays and the difficulties of writing them, you know?
Yeah, and not be precluded, not precluding those possible interpretations.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
To be accurate, but also to be accurate to a set of interpretations, you know?
Yeah. No, I like that. Another one. This is summer of 2023. These are award winners you have for prose. So two of them stood out to me. One was Inside Lane, L.J. Sisko. Now, I admit I was on swim teams as a boy. That might have been a little bit of it. I was actually on a swim team. It was all the way through 12th graders, and I was in second grade. So these were grown men as far as I was concerned. And I was small enough at that point in life that I actually climbed inside my locker to change at the very first practice. Just to shield myself from, the whole situation, basically. So this is also a locker room, and it's a predator, as I would understand it, who is described as having wide whale corduroys that scissor as he walks, which I found really memorable. Took me back to that style that you don't see a lot around anymore. But there's a girl who's described as Lane Six. That's the name given to her. And as best I can gather, it seems as though she may have been a victim. And as a victim, if I'm reading it correctly, and I may not be, she might have been therefore someone who precluded the author from having that same fate. Obviously it's a horrible situation. If I understand it correctly, that you've got Inside Lane, because he's got lots of time with them. They're literally, you know, all but naked in their swimsuits. There is physical and emotional vulnerability here, and it's a boarding school. So you've got that angle as well. The parents are not around, but this person is around. Your comments, responses, what drew you? Maybe my interpretation's off base. If so, I'm prepared to stand corrected.
Yeah. So in the story, the narrator, the swim teacher actually kisses the speaker. I think, you know, it's just what drew me to this story was the voice. I think that it's really hard to write about these really charged topics. And yet the retrospective insight that LJ puts into this piece is fantastic. You know, it's about this violation, but it's also about kind of the things that women or girls are asked to carry. One of the most interesting lines in the piece is when she's like, we thought of him as the victim because he's so old and lonely.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is all he has and how pathetic he is. And yet we're as girls take on that, the responsibility to make this grown man happy in some way. And I think there's just something really heartbreaking about it. And it was a fabulous, it was a close contender in the prose prize, and just really excited. And she's a poet as well. Her poetry is fantastic. Was lucky enough to meet her at AWP, and her story just, it resonated with a lot of our readers as well.
You know, because one of the things that I think goes on, and you see almost every week, seemingly, a story from the sports world where there's unfortunately been some sexual violence. And you're in a milieu, and I've done work actually for teams in the NBA and other, you know, NCAA Division I sports teams. And the whole culture is quite aggressive and assertive and a competition, and you're going to win. And where does that aggressiveness go? How does it get manifest? Who is drawn to it in the first place? Here you have a team because it's a team sport, and as well as individual competition, and they are looking out for each other in their way, even if their parents aren't there to do it. I'm not surprised it would resonate for a lot of people. Gerald, anything you wanted to add regarding the discussion?
Yeah, for me, what's masterful about that is the way that LJ recreates the ominousness of the environment. So more than just like telling what happened, more than like telling, you know, what she felt at the time or kind of, you know, in hindsight, I think what my sense is that what speaks to people is building the ominousness of that environment. And with that ominousness is, I don't even know if that's the nominal amount, but with that is kind of the sense of like, oh, like, I don't know what's going on. I don't, you know, and like kind of oscillating between the.
It's murky. Yeah. It reminds me a bit of Picnic of Hanging Rock because there's a foreboding to that movie and we never do know what happens. We just know it's nothing good. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Like whether like, you know, there was the kiss and that's definitely a violation. And this is a story about survivors, you know, but also to what extent, you know, there are further kind of assaults. It's kind of beside the point because it's like either way it's bad, you know, the environment, you know, it's not about, you know, a list of actions.
Yeah, no, it's the feelings you're left with and the sense of vulnerability. I do, before we leave it, there was one line I really liked a lot. I have several friends who went to boarding schools and it's not the easiest experience. I didn't have it myself, but there's a line where she writes, "Borders were connected to their parents the way an orbiting astronaut is to ground control." I just thought it was a great line. Said a lot, very softly, but very profoundly. Yeah, good stuff. One more before we leave. This is Brian Trong's. This is, I believe, the award winner. And it's called Fake Handbags. I must say, I don't know that I can relate to this in that I don't go shopping very much. It certainly grabbed my attention. I mean, it's got, pun intended, a wealth of details. I have a few things I want to say about it, but I'm going to let you guys jump in first.
Yeah, so this is an emerging writer. He's an amazing writer who's working on a collection of essays and a memoir. And the essay that that you're talking about, and I think it's online. I think you can access it. So check our website. We have a bunch of like stuff posted, no paywall, no pop-ups. You just go and click it. And if LJ's essay isn't online, we'll post it for sure so people can get to it so that you can share it with your friends, Dan.
Okay.
But it's reflecting on the story of a tense kind of family unit, you know? It's about two kids who learn through an experience of going to New York and shopping for fake handbags, about, you know, a father's kind of anger management problems and kind of the hidden, you know, what the parents have been hiding from the parents and how the revelation of that kind of ramifies to the father-son relationship. And
or lack thereof, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You know, it doesn't let the father off the hook, but then, you know, it's brave enough to give kind of touching kind of commentary about the father as well.
Yeah. Stop trying to castigate. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so, I don't know. There's so much I could say about it. I don't know what you liked about it or.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's an essay that reads like a story in that it has such a narrative arc. And I think, you know, Brian just does a fantastic job kind of putting these memories, these sequences, very much grounded in place and in seeing this family whose dad is constantly working, and they save up for these trips to New York, and then kind of look at these fake handbags and kind of imagine this like American dream life for themselves. To me, it's a very Asian American story, and I think that there's like, you know, it's just a really compassionate essay. I think you know, the father is complicated, and his relationship with his mother is like all of it, what they're dreaming about, what they're striving for. I think it feels really it's a compelling narrative, in the way that he's able to use kind of retrospective insights to really imbue the scenes with meaning, I think is really masterful.
Sure. No, I thought there was a whole cosmology he managed to create, and the contrast of the layers within the layers I thought were amazing. For instance, the father works in a clean room, but there he is on rather grungy Canal Street looking at handbags. They are knockoffs. He is literally knocking or hitting, you know, his wife behind doors, and the children hear it. The kids are, you know, trying to get themselves almost protected by the brand halo of these, you know, luxury goods. And yet they have no emotional safety themselves, and not necessarily even physical safety, along with the mother. There's just so much richness to what's going on there, in amongst, you know, a paltry attempt at richness, because they're saving up their discount cards from the restaurants to go out and gorge themselves on less than fabulous fare, and they do it over and over. So everyone's totally full, and everyone's totally starving in this novel, or this narrative essay at all times. That's what really got me in the end. Yeah.
I mean, the stories are very telling, and they're very, you know, what I love about they're very telling, and they're very kind of firm about certain things, right? Like, you know, the dad is, his anger is not good. It's not that complicated, yeah. You know, but there is also kind of, it's really deliberate about what it is stalwart about, and then what it, you know, other tracks of thought that it's willing to, you know, be more arable and more kind of ambivalent about, you know. And I think like that's an essay, right? It's like, I think even more so than a novel can, I think, be absolutely ambivalent, and it can work in as an aesthetic kind of creation. But like being accurate, I think, with Alex Chi, or I read Vivian Gornick's New York Review book essay on Laura Siegel this morning. She's like an essay that needs to be like, what's the point? You know, like that's the call that pushes a memoirist rather than the novelist being like, isn't it interesting, to be very deliberate about, you know, what is stalwart and important. I think this essay does it really well.
Yeah, I think for me as a reader, I want to know where the essayist lands. You know, how it feels, what it provoked for them, thoughts, mm-hmm. connections, mentally, socially, with those in their inner circle. Yeah. So all good stuff. I'm going to try to draw to a close here. I want to thank you both for joining me. This is Great New American Essays. The focus this time has been on the Georgia Review. I've been fortunate enough to be joined by its editor, Gerald Ma, and the magazine's associate prose editor, Maggie Sue. Until next time, take care and be well.